When I sat my first Vipassana retreat, it was in Thailand, and I was had found myself to a small, chaotic, wild little meditation center, monastery on the edge of Bangkok. And I was given a kuti, a little hut, one-room hut with a little porch to do all my practice in, sitting in the hut. And next to it, and it was in a swamp, the kind of, right where I was, it was kind of dry, but the hut was up on high stilts. And then there was a little porch, and some couple of steps went down, and then there was planks of wood that went out across the top where sometimes there was a swamp. To where it was dry, and I would do my meditation there and spend much of the day there, sleep there. It was kind of nice, and I was not a monk in that tradition then, and so every morning the monks in the monastery would go out for the alms rounds to gather their food, and they would go out with their bowl and wander around the neighborhood, and they would come back with food. And that food was all gathered together, and then at around 10:30 or so, we would have our big meal of the day with that food that was kind of divided up and put out on the table, and we'd serve ourselves. And the monks would get all kinds of things. They get rice and curries, but sometimes they get little bags of cookies and a variety of different things, and fruits. So, but I wasn't part of that, so I was left in the monastery to meditate in my kuti. And it was early in the morning, so I was up meditating one morning and meditating in my inside. And then I went, I finished my meditation, and I got up, and I opened the door of this little hut, and as I opened the door, my eyes went down on the porch, and on the porch was an apple and some cookies. And then my eyes continued down the steps and on the planks, so that long planks going to the dry part of the ground. Looked down, and there on the end of those planks, I saw the back of a monk walking away. And the only place to go was to my hut, because there was nowhere else he could have gone. So it was pretty clear that he was the one to put it there. And but why this experience was so significant for me, why I'm telling you now, is in my little mind, you know, at that time, I was just kind of floored, surprised, that he would that he had left something for me, a gift, that was nice, I appreciated it, but that he didn't want any credit. He didn't want to be known. It wasn't like he was concerned about being known. And this idea that he would offer something with no thanks, no wanting any recognition or any of the exchange things that can happen. I'd been sitting for several weeks by then. It was a long retreat. It was a 10-week retreat. So I was pretty sensitive. And something inside of me resonated really deeply with what he had done. I don't really know what he did, of course. Maybe I was projecting, but it didn't matter. It resonated. Something about that, seeing him walk away, seeing the gift, resonated with a place of freedom inside, a place where I could imagine that I could do the same thing, that I didn't have to get credit, I didn't have to be recognized for doing something, that there could be this spontaneous wish or flow of generosity, of giving, and that it would come from a place inside of being free of self-centered ideas, free of wanting something in return. And having that resonate with something inside, recognizing that for myself, recognizing something in me that, it was more like maybe it resonated to something real, but in my mind it was theoretical in the sense that I could imagine it was possible to have that. Wow, that's something that can be done. I recognize a possibility, potential inside. And this has been one of the qualities of Dharma practice for some people, and we hope for all of us, that as we practice, as we encounter the Dharma in all its many forms, that we see ourselves in it. We recognize ourselves. We recognize our potential. We recognize that potential of our hearts to be free, to be generous, to be compassionate, to be loving, to be uninhibited, to be free of hate and greed and fear. That these are something that we can feel and experience and know for ourselves. There's a story of a monk in old days in India who had probably done something significant, I don't know what, but the local king had given him a bowl, you know, the begging bowls they walk around in, that was made of gold. And so it was worth a lot of money. It was a really expensive thing. And this monk wandered around the countryside, living the life of a monk, and he would sleep in different places, just under trees or outdoors sometimes, and wherever he ended up. And he was sleeping in a little grove of trees one day, and with his bowl shining in the moonlight next to him. And a thief happened to be nearby and walked by, and the thief saw what was there. The monk was sleeping, the gold bowl was there, and seems like a pretty obvious thing for a thief to do, and to take the bowl. So he did. And he left, and the next morning, next day, so the story goes, so he went over to steal the bowl, and I guess he stepped on some branches or something and woke up the monk up, and as he was walking away with the bowl, the monk said, "Oh, you can have it." And so he took it and he left. Came back the next day and he said, "I took that bowl and I felt so poor. You're rich in having the ability just to offer it." The monk had no possessions except for maybe the bowl. Here. So this idea of richness, what is it to be rich? What is it to be poor? And in the Dharma, rich wealth is not measured by possessions, but it's measured by qualities of the heart. And to, in the Dharma practice, and in other ways, to begin tapping into recognizing qualities of heart that we have. And there's many of them. We have an abundance of treasures within us, waiting for us to tap into, waiting for us to utilize. And so things like the Brahma-viharas, things like loving-kindness and compassion and sympathetic joy and equanimity are treasures that we have. And to learn to recognize them in ourselves, have them be awakened and flow from us. And these paramitas that we're talking about today are also treasures, and that we can reckon. They're not something external. They're not exactly like commandments that you should do these things, and they're not really practices. They can be practices. Practices can be part of what their ecology is about, but they're not like something external that you're going to import into yourself and put on like a coat or suit of armor or something. But they're really qualities of your own heart that you have, that hopefully with time you'll recognize, and more than recognize, but you'll slough off the barriers to them. You'll drop away the things that get in the way of them flowing freely for you. And these six paramitas are generosity, ethics, patience, effort or virya, dhyana, zen, concentration, and wisdom. And these are all, these are treasures for us to have. And in both the Theravada and the Mahayana tradition, these paramitas, in the Pali they're called paramis, they have a slightly different list, but the same idea, are understood to be qualities of heart that are evoked and tapped into and expressed on the path to not just liberation, but liberation to serve all beings, to practice liberation not for just for ourselves, but to practice liberation for the welfare and happiness and freedom of others. And it's my kind of belief, I don't know what else to say, belief, it's more, I'd like to say my knowing, because it's so deep inside of me, this, it's so obvious, but that this is how it is, that we can't really practice the path of liberation as far as it potentially can go for us if we only practice it for ourselves. Just kind of not just simply possible. Because to practice for oneself, there's a kind of inherent in that is benefit for ourselves. It's useful to do. Some people, it's absolutely essential. For most people, I would say, to practice for oneself. There's nothing wrong with doing that. But at some point, we come up to a place where it's limiting to operate under the idea of self. What's in it for me? Improving myself. Helping myself to be free of suffering, helping myself be free of my distress and challenges. At some point it becomes so much freer, so much happier, so much more expansive to not kind of stop with oneself, but take that impulse for liberation, that impulse for freedom, impulse for love and compassion, and have it spread out and take care of others as equally as one would do for oneself. There's a Zen story in China of a Zen master named Wahei, I think. Was that his name? Wahei? My Zen is rusty. But it's one of the stories that inspired me. Huhei, maybe? Who was it? And someone came to the Zen master and said, what's the entry gate to Zen? And the Zen master said, dana, the first paramita of generosity, of giving. And the student said, I love just that part of the story, just that's the entryway, it's the gate. And but then the student goes on and says, well, why is that the entry? But there's five other paramitas. So why should that be the entryway? And the Zen master said, it's because all the other five paramitas flow out of generosity. That generosity is their source. And that's a kind of very provocative statement, I think, evocative statement. What is it about generosity that contains and gives birth to these other paramitas? When I was probably a teenager, I can only say probably knew that generosity was a good idea. I don't even remember, generosity wasn't really in my, I knew what the word meant, but it wasn't really part of my, working life, my life that I lived so much. And the idea that of being generous, was a little bit suspect. People who are generous, I didn't really trust, and maybe they're being selfish in some way, wanting something in return. And also that, it's maybe people who are just a little bit too good for their own sake to be generous, and something like that. It was never articulated, but I didn't. Wasn't just something I grew up with, but to discover that inherent in a certain movement of generosity are things like ethics and concentration and wisdom and these qualities that are there for this the benefit of others. That's quite an amazing discovery. So that generosity is not whatever benefits generosity is. It's a simple act of generosity. It has tremendous benefit, or you can tap into, or it can resonate, or it can recognize something inside of us is much bigger than generosity, much more extensive, the ecology of giving. It's a wonderful way to be in relationship to other people. The Buddha said that generosity unifies friends, creates concord, creates harmony together. But in our own hearts, how is it being generous helps us to be more ethical? How is it that being generous helps us to be patient? How is it that being generous helps us to make the effort, the word for effort is virya, which kind of means heroic effort. It's kind of like a little bit higher bar than just making effort. And what is it that, about generosity that supports or evokes a strong, unshakable kind of effort and practice in our lives? What is it about generosity that gives birth to concentration? If I had known that when I was younger, I wouldn't have gotten so many headaches meditating, because I tried so hard, and probably in a kind of greedy way, and maybe miserly way, to get concentrated and my concentration, and all these other people have to leave me alone, be quiet, because it's mine, I'm almost there, leave me alone. What is it about generosity that supports and makes possible to get concentrated? And what is it about the movement of generosity, that movement of giving, of opening up, of handing out, letting go, that gives birth to wisdom? That's the question for you to answer. That's a question, I think, to discover. And in discovering the answers to those questions, the hope is you're discovering yourself, discovering something about who you are, that something in you gets awoken and discovered and released and freed. And in that way, these paramitas are not so much something that we have to do, but something that we allow for. They're not something that we have, but something that we are. We be this. And so we recognize it and then we be it. So in this story where the student asks the Zen master about the entry gate to Zen, the Zen master says, the five other paramitas issue out of generosity. Then the student says, why is it called dana? And the Zen master says, it's called dana because it's relinquishment, or it's letting go. And then the Zen master goes on to say that in dana, we're relinquishing greed. We're relinquishing self and other. We're relinquishing good and bad. We're relinquishing all these ways in which the mind categorizes and relates to things that creates limitations on the openness of being, the openness of heart, the openness of mind. That generosity in its full potential is not simply giving cookies to someone on their little hut, like happened to me in Thailand, but generosity in its full potential is to really let go, not of what we're giving, but even let go of the ways in which we think that limit us, hold us in, stop us from really letting things flow freely that are here within us, our potential inside. And so even the idea of there being a receiver or a giver, look at me, what a good giver I am, that interferes with the full expression of generosity. So the kind of letting go, too, of needing to be anything or receive anything or be defined by the thing. And there is a giver, a receiver. I mean, kind of have to operate to the idea of a receiver if you're giving to something to someone. But in that full giving, in the movement of full giving, there's also letting go of the receiver. So the receiver doesn't have to be the receiver. The receiver can just be too. We don't have to box them in. And you better say thank you. You better remember. You just received something. You better be a receiver from now on, or something. Just like this. Generosity, nothing needs to happen here. This is what it is. So here we are, first day of the retreat. And it might not be the best obvious day to talk about generosity, except that there's such a strong tradition in Buddhism that the paramitas begin with generosity. This path or practice can begin with generosity. So how is it that generosity is relevant on the first day of the retreat, sitting here, when first day of the retreats can often be difficult? How many of you were tireder today than you expected to be? Look around, in case you thought you were the only one. How many of you, your body hurt more than you expected it to hurt? How many of you were discouraged today? How many decided it was hopeless? And so this is often, you know, how many of you had a headache today? Not as many as some retreats, thank you. It's a big shift to come on retreat. The whole psychophysical system shifts and changes, and the body adjusts and has to find its way, and we're working out the kinks of our daily life, the kinks in our minds, kinks in our bodies, and we're often tired the first day. It's a big deal to come on retreat. Americans, people living in this culture, are often a greater need of sleep than they are of meditation. It's a sleep-deprived culture. And just coming on retreat, people are often packing and being busy and staying up late and being even more busy, and so they come exhausted, or they travel long distances. And then they get tired the first day, normal response is to get discouraged. This is terrible. You know, it was so important for me to come, and I can't even stay awake. And then I better try harder. And the harder you try, the less it works. And when you try to do something, you're supposed to be successful. So you're not succeeding. So the obvious thing to do is to be discouraged. But it's just a normal part of the first day, and part of the wise approach, I think, is to be gracious and generous to yourself for being tired, for being achy, for having a headache, to be compassionate, caring. This is how it is. This is the first day. This is, who knows, the causes and conditions that make this possible here. But let's meet this with generosity. And what would it mean for you to be generous to yourself in this circumstance, to hold yourself with a generous heart, to hold yourself with a generous mind? And one of the things I like to believe that it involves is not doing the opposite, and not being critical or angry at yourself or angry at the retreat center. How could they, whose idea was this? These Buddhists, or to be self-critical, or to, all kinds of, or to give up. Giving up is not a generous thing to do. So what does it mean to be generous to yourself in this circumstance? If you're really tired, maybe it's being generous to take a nap and come back refreshed. Maybe it's being very forgiving or very spacious or gracious. And maybe the practice of the first day is learning to be gracious. Like you would be gracious to someone who's maybe challenging in your life or good, so you're gracious. Gracious host. So how would you be a host to yourself in the difficulties of today? One of the ways is not to have a high standard to measure yourself against. If I'm not in the third jhana by the third sitting, I'm probably failed. But just to be very generous. And part of the advantage of being generous to oneself and generous to others is, or one of the aspects of it, is the generosity of allowing someone to be themselves, to allow yourself to be yourself. Here I am. I'm challenged. I have all these strong feelings and emotions, and I have all this momentum in my mind. My mind keeps thinking so much about these concerns I have, and this is how it is right now. This is what I am right now. I'm a high-speed thinker. Whatever, this is what it is. And there's something about being generous to yourself, allowing yourself to be who you are, which is different than, I don't exactly know the language of this, but it's different than condoning it, or different than accepting it in such a way that you're indulging in it, or supporting it or fueling it. There's something about the movement of generosity, Dharma generosity, where we allow ourselves to be as we are. That's a way of stepping, kind of like stepping back and opening up and say, it's like this. And the movement is like, oh, it's like this. And so in that, there's more space for the whatever is contracted to unwind, to open up, to recognize what's here, to recognize what's happening, and go, oh, it's like this. Or the other image that I like is that of imagining awareness as two hands that cup themselves together, and it comes underneath whatever's happening, and say, oh, and just hold it, it's like this. This generosity of just allowing yourself to be, it's, oh, it's like this, a headache. It's like this, and just hold it and be with it. It's like this to be critical of myself, to be discouraged. Just hold it like this. It's like this to be anxious, or like this to be, like, or anxiety and fear, it's better to go like this. It's like, oh, come here. And so it's not feeding it, it's not getting involved in it, but it's making space for it so that it can unfold, it can evolve, it can do what it needs to do. And it's a beautiful thing in our ecology of our minds and bodies and hearts, is there seems to be a movement towards healing, a movement towards wholeness, a movement towards freedom that is not personal in the sense that I have to do it and I have to make it. It has a lot to do with getting out of the way and allowing it to unfold. And this idea, and the generosity of allowing our life to unfold in a field of strong awareness, to be really present, to be with it, the experience, fully. And then be generous to allow it to do, show itself, let it reveal itself, let it do what it needs to do. Kind of like get yourself out of the way to let who's here, what's here, to open and flow. Just like the relinquishment of giver and receiver disappears, so in that kind of giving of ourselves and letting be, there's a way in which some of the usual definitions of self, the way we limit ourselves, are, and the usual kind of desires and wanting and stuff that goes on, aversions, has a chance to kind of fall away. The usual concepts fall away. And there's an openness, a greater presence, a greater allowing that can happen in that generosity. Just this, here. And so it's not a generosity that requires anything to be different than what it is. But it's a generosity that allows each thing to be what it is so that it can unfold, move, change, so it can show itself, show you its changing nature that it has. So this idea that of the paramitas being part of the potential of who we are inside, it relates to how there's a tremendous potential waiting to be tapped in, waiting to unfold. And in the Mahayana tradition, sometimes that's called Buddha nature. In Theravada Buddhism, they don't use that language. But if you go back to the ancient suttas of the Buddha, there's no word that corresponds to Buddha nature except for dharmata, the nature of the Dharma nature that's used. And it's the Dharma nature that for it to unfold, to move, to flow. And it's kind of a miracle, it's kind of a marvelous thing that what's in our hearts, what's here waiting for us. There are these ways of speaking in English that uses the word giving. A lot of words, a lot of little expressions, funny ones. But one of them is not giving, is having to do with attention. We say about paying attention. I never quite could figure out why do we end up saying paying attention? I'm going to pay attention to something. Maybe something I don't know about what paying means, but I thought it meant like you buy something. You pay for something to buy something. So paying attention seems odd. But luckily we also have give my attention. We give our attention to things. And that makes more sense. That attention is something we can give. We can give our attention to someone. A friend in need benefits from our attention, our presence, our company. So we give our attention. A friend is grieving and having a difficult time. And would you like me to pay attention to you? And that has a very, very different feeling than can I give you some time? Can I be with you and offer some attention here or something? So this idea that attention itself is an act of generosity. And how is it that attention is generous? How would you answer that question? What is it to be generous? In what way is that? What is it about paying attention? There I go. See how easy? What is it about being attentive that inherent in the attention is an act of generosity? And that you're practicing generosity in bringing attention to what's going on. And one way I've seen it, one answer to this is something that I think I've really only understood as it being a Buddhist teacher and having talked to many, many people over these years and talked about their lives and their practice and what goes on. And I've talked to people with lots of suffering. And one of the forms of suffering that seems to be pretty big for people who go through it are people who, as children, were not seen. They'll tell me, I was never seen. No one recognized me. My parents didn't really see me. They ignored me, and they were never home, or no one kind of believed in me. No one saw me. And there's something about that not being seen as a child that is pretty debilitating. It's part of the maturation process that allows for healthy growing up, is to really be seen, be mirrored. And it's something about not being seen. It's like being seen and loved are the same thing. Not being seen is like not being loved, which is, pretty terrible not to be loved in the formative times when we're growing up. And so there's something about being seen that it's like being loved. There's something in the act of attention which there's kind of like something like love in it. And as adults, this is something we can offer ourselves. There's something about offering this unconditional, open willingness to be attentive to what's here. And to be attentive and see it and to settle in, to relax, to focus, to be steady, to just wake up to this and see it. That is also an act of love, the love that recognizes what's there and is not in conflict with it, not struggling with anything. And I think that one of the greatest gifts that we can give to ourselves and the world is to discover the art of how to make our way in this world without being in conflict with anything. Things might be in conflict with us, we might have disagreements, but conflict means to be taking an oppositional stand, means resisting, means closing down, being constricted. And to learn how not to be in conflict, I think, is a powerful aspect of the Dharma. Since the ancient times, one of the descriptions of the Dharma, what characterizes the Dharma, in the ancient tradition says it's ahimsa, non-harming. To live in the world without any harm is the Dharma. Something about that so closely connected. Not cause any harm. So that first retreat I sat in Thailand, it was very impactful, many little stories. I was there for 10 weeks meditating, but little things happen here and there. And I met this monk who came to visit the monastery, and he was known as being a meditation monk. Not all monks in Thailand are meditation monks. And I was told that, you know, he'd spent years meditating, deep meditator, and I was told that he had the ability of entering into this particular deep meditation experience of cessation, where you can sit for 7 days and seven nights without moving and just in this state of cessation, and then he comes out. It's considered very, very high attainment. So I met him, and I looked into his eyes, and at least his eyes told me that probably something like that was true. There was this depth and stillness and vastness and peacefulness, and there was something, it was amazing to look into his eyes and be with him. So I asked him, in all your years of being a monk, what have you attained? What have you realized? And he said, non-contention. I was a little bit surprised. What? Non-contention? All this meditation and deep practice and, you know, you ended up just non-contention? I'm a slow learner. And so, after a while I thought about it and realized that. With time I came to appreciate that was a great answer. What a great attainment. Non-contention. So how are you here? What's the practice of non-contention? What's the practice of generosity? How can you practice being generous here at the retreat center? Not in a way that agitates you, not in a way that gets you up in your head thinking and planning all the different ways to be generous, but what does it look like to be in a generous state of mind, a generous mood, a generous attitude that helps your heart and mind to settle, to feel at home, to feel safe, to feel contented, to just be at ease? What's the attitude of generosity that helps there be a stilling and a quieting so that it becomes more open, more available, more allowing of each thing to just be itself and to reveal itself in the space of awareness, the space of mind, the space of heart? So what is the entry gate to liberation? Generosity. So it's the custom here that at the end of a talk to kind of go back into meditation posture and kind of get reestablished in the ongoing practice.